This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting WindroseRecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
Hi, everybody. I'm Alan Schwartz, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. This is your first time here. Thanks for listening. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 104 for January 12th, 2021. Jack London was born on this day in 1876. Also, the birthday of John Hancock and Ira Hayes and a couple classic country guys, Ray Price and Tex Ritter, who was also a member of Congress. And this day in 1879, the British Zulu War began. In 1908, a wireless message was sent long distance for the first time from the Eiffel Tower. And in 1991, Congress gave the green light for military action against Iraq and the Persian Gulf crisis. This episode was recorded on January 6th, which will be another memorable day. Crazy. We didn't really get into that during our conversation. So on this podcast, I've talked a little bit about some of the stuff I've been through in my life. I'm relatively open about the fact that I'm a person in long-term recovery, which for me means I haven't had a drink since September 7th of 1996. And the last day I drank on September 6th, a lot of things happened, but one of the things that happened is, at the insistence of one of my sisters, I called a rehab. It was this addiction treatment facility in West Palm Beach, Florida, where my sister had gone a year prior, and it changed her life in a really profound way. And she wanted her little brother to have the same experience. She was worried about me. She was watching what I was doing with my life. And as this is going on, I was going a stretch about I don't know, at least a week where all I was doing was drinking. I had a job, but, you know, it was construction and, you know, I was traveling and it was this period of time where we were waiting for material to finish this job. And so I have nothing to do for a couple weeks and all I did was drink. It was a mess. And so that day I picked up the phone and I made a call to this facility. And the guy who answered the phone is the guest for this episode. His name's Alan Schwartz. I talk a little bit about our conversation in this episode, but, you know, I was drunk. I mean, I was off my rocker, and it was a pleasant conversation in the beginning. And, you know, I ended up getting pretty nasty with him, and he was just as patient as he could possibly be. And so then, you know, I ended up apologizing to him a few days later when I ended up down here. I grew up in Indiana, so, you know, I came to the facility here in West Palm Beach, where I've been ever since. And he's remained in my life this whole entire time, obviously. So a couple years of sobriety and I got a job at the same facility where I went and where he worked. I trained as a counselor there. I'd see him around as the years went on. And at one point had an opportunity to bring him on board at another place where I was working, which was a real treat. And, you know, Alan's just one of those guys who he makes you smile when you see him. Very upbeat, jovial, fun. Also caring and has an enormous heart. So just such a pleasure to be able to have Alan on here and to have this conversation with him. He's such a gift. And we kind of go all over the place on this conversation. We talk about his life. We talk about 12-step recovery. We talk about jazz. We talk about all kinds of stuff. But we had a lot of fun. And, you know, you definitely get a feel for Alan in this episode. And, you know, I can never thank him enough for being the person who welcomed me to a new and better life. So thank you, Alan, and I hope you enjoy it. Alan Schwartz.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide. From the government's crying eye.
Alan, so good to have you. Thank you for doing this. And I've really been looking forward to talking to you because, you know, we have quite a history, don't we?
Remarkable, remarkable history.
Yeah. And you're just one of those people who, well, you hold a special place in my heart. You know, you were the guy who was there to welcome me through the door to a better life. And it's been such a treat to be able to remain in each other's lives for, you know, it'll be 25 years in September, Alan, God willing. Oh,
God, a quarter of a century.
I know. And you know, it's just something that brings me a lot of joy. Aside from the fact that you're the guy who answered the phone.
That's what is most riveting about our relationship.
Yeah. What do you remember about that phone call, Alan?
You know, I was working admissions at the Hanley Hazelden Center in West Palm Beach. I had finished maybe 2 years working as an assistant counselor, a residential tech, working on the different floors. I think I worked a year as an assistant in the family program that was on the weekend. So very, I had, you know, I went through the APT training, you know, just wonderful. But I really found a home in admissions.
Mm.
And it's something to be able to be privileged to speak to someone on the phone. And it could either be the individual or a family member or someone that was concerned about the addictive use of their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And when I actually got to speak to people that were genuinely just miserable, I hear the sound of misery in your voice, Tom. Mm. And I could so readily identify with it and pick up on it and just simply allow myself to be present.
Mm-hmm.
And so your call, though treatment may have been a gift to you, your call was certainly a gift to me to be able to make it okay to proceed and go further and make a plan to give this a try.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, I fast forward a couple years after that phone call, I was in a chair next to you in that admissions department. I don't know if you remember, but I'd moonlight over there a night a week at one point.
Where was this?
At Hanley in the admissions department. I was working in marketing, but I worked over in admissions to help you guys out, and you trained me in the admissions department.
Right.
Yeah. And you know what I, aside from remembering a couple calls that came in of people who are still in our lives, who I won't mention, and being there for those calls. Yeah. Aside from that, I remember, you know, one of the things that I've always loved music. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was always important to me in my recovery, I had this attitude that, you know, well, if I'm not going to drink or smoke pot, man, I'm going to have fun and I'm going to do the things I want to do. And, you know, I had these things that I wanted to do. And a couple of them were, I wanted to learn how to play guitar at some point because I'd tried it before and never had the patience for it. And another thing I wanted to do was learn about jazz because I knew it was cool, but I didn't know why.
Oh my God.
And, you know, so I started in my early recovery picking up some jazz records. And the first one was kind of an obscure John Coltrane release called Meditations or something like that. And then the next one was a compilation of Miles Davis's Blue Note songs, which I loved, all those old standards. But you turned me on to Mingus.
Oh, Mingus, yeah.
Which, you know, folks, if you like music and you like a little funk and you're open to jazz, Charles Mingus.
Oh, God.
It's really good stuff. But, and I remember you talking to me about all that. And you, now tell me about your experience with jazz. Because didn't you come of age around the jazz scene in New York?
Jazz was my lifesaver. When I was in high school, we used to have a radio show in New York City called Symphony Sid. And I would stay up all night under the covers listening to my little transistor radio with an earphone to some of the greatest sounds of jazz as it was evolving in the late 50s, mid to late 50s, early 60s. I graduated high school in 1964. So jazz was what really fed my soul.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that I would sneak away from home on a weekend night with my friend my friend Harry. Harry is now the professor at Adelphi University that's been teaching the doctoral programs over the past 10 or 15 years there. So Harry and I would steal our way into the village and bring a bottle of wine, not from somewhere, and hang out by these jazz clubs. You know, if we could afford to get in, we got in. If not, we stayed nearby. We just hung out, loved jazz, Downbeat magazine, the whole nine yards. Our contemporaries were more into rock and roll as it was slowly evolving. But it wasn't until the Beatles came out that I started to even listen to rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, and you know, jazz was the rock and roll before rock and roll, right?
Oh, jazz was very, very hip. I mean, the whole blues, the evolution of blues into jazz is so deeply embedded within me. One of the things, you were talking about playing the guitar. When I was a kid, I had piano lessons, and I was into jazz. And I was bar mitzvahed already, so I was like 13, you know, and listening to jazz. And I told my music teacher, you know, I wanted to learn jazz. So her idea of jazz was Hoagie Carmichael, Stardust, you know. And I was into, at that time, Thelonious Monk. I mean, the dissonance, you know, how do you do this, you know? But even more significant, Tom, you know, our lives sometimes track over courses we can't even imagine. I was so blessed with some of the remarkable experiences I've had. When I first went to school, I entered as a pre-med bio major at Stony Brook, which at that time only had 1,600 students. It was the second year it was on campus. And I was able to get a job on their campus radio, WUSB, with a jazz show I ran from midnight to 2 a.m.
Wow.
And I'd say, good evening, this is A. Spencer Schwartz over WUSB, bringing to you some of the finer sounds of jazz and other entertainment. Well, that led me into emceeing the concert. So I have emceed concerts with Mose Allison is one of my favorites. Man. You know Mose Allison?
No, not as well versed as you are probably at all. But
I made my entrance on the
I love his voice. Yeah.
That kind of funky tune. Yeah. Mose Allison lived in Smithtown, which was not too far from Stony Brook. But I also emceed Dave Brubeck. When he had Paul Desmond, Eugene Wright on the beat, Paul Desmond, clarinetist, unbelievable. And we talked, you know, with Dave about his son that had a rock and roll band, you know. Count Basie, they came with two busloads of hungry musicians. I had to hustle through the cafeteria and whip up Frank.
Oh, now that's an awesome story.
I mean, and you talk about Thelonious Monk, how we got him on campus, I have no idea.
Well, you know, it's funny. One of the more recent records I've purchased, and I do buy records, vinyl.
Vinyl? Got a good needle?
I did. Wow, good enough. It plays. I mean, it sounds good. There is there's a previously unreleased Monk concert recording that came out a couple months ago. He's being recorded at, what's the name of the town where Stanford is?
Stanford, Connecticut?
No. Stanford University.
Oh, it's in California.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. The high school in that city, which I'm drawing a blank on the name right now, which drives me crazy. But anyway, there was a kid who, he was like the music club guy or the AV guy or something at this high school.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a time when Monk was on a hiatus from touring, but he somehow, evidently it was a time when Monk needed to make some money and he was getting out and the guy knew he was going to be in California anyway. And he got him to come play at his high school.
Wow.
And recorded it And then this guy went on, I can't remember his name, but he's somebody I actually, after I got this record, I got the guy's contact information to see if I could get him on here. But he went on to, you know, book acts at the Fillmore and, you know, ended up becoming a significant figure in the music scene out west. Oh,
God, isn't that something to talk about?
Palo Alto High School.
Silicon
Monk at Palo Alto. Yeah, it's great, too. It's a really great record. I love it. Oh,
God.
Yeah.
You know, my wife has been a jazz singer most of her life. She actually had a band when she was in high school that played at Radio City Music Hall. And she's a protege of Dr. Barry Harris, who's now in his late 80s, early 90s. Barry Harris was a bebop jazz guy from Detroit. He teaches classes internationally that are packed with young jazz students. And for our honeymoon, I went to one of the jazz classes he gave in Rome. Just extraordinary, extraordinary. His energy level is unbelievable. So Connie is incredibly well-versed in the jazz world, and she's blessed with an incredible voice. But, you know, I mentioned that jazz was my salvation in high school. I would go to, we had a piano, so we had a music room, and I would play for hours on end. My music teacher didn't know what jazz was. I stopped music lessons and just created these inventions, you know, that would just fly off of my fingers. Just extraordinary. And it's interesting that, you know, when I've played with other groups, I've played, I jammed with other incredible musicians. I have a limited vocabulary, but the one thing that happened to me when I got sober is I never played music again. It seems like a contradiction almost, you know, but it's just the nature of my path. And I love that you brought up that jazz connection, because you gave me a beautiful Art Blakey album framed.
No. It was a Mingus record.
Oh, it was Mingus?
It was, yeah.
Okay.
Mingus at the Vanguard.
Oh, my God.
I know, because it's got a great cover. He's got a cigarette in one hand. You can't see it, but you see the smoke rising up over his face. It's a really cool picture, right?
Great.
And no, it's I realized because I wanted to give that to you, but I didn't want to let go of that record, and then I ended up ordering another one.
Yeah, the conflict of interest.
Yeah.
It's outrageous, because one of my roommates at Stony Brook was Chuck Colstein. And his father, Colstein, is a manufacturer, a major manufacturer of top-end basses that knew Mingus.
Okay. So
that's probably how we got him to come to play at Stony Brook.
So you mentioned getting sober.
Oh, sober.
And you're not the first person who, by the way, who I've met over the years who played a lot of music but never played again when they got sober. Occasionally, you know,
somebody,
I've met other people who've that's happened with, but, so you describe yourself as a recovery advocate. And so can you tell us a little bit about, obviously you talked about working in addiction treatment. How is it thumbnail sketch of how you ended up needing to become abstinent? What was going on?
To become abstinent goes back to 1988.
Okay.
And in 1988, I hit what they call a bottom. Yeah. What a term. I hit a bottom. You know, a lot of, as I've come to understand the underbelly of my addiction to mind and mood altering substances, and in my case, primarily alcohol was the driving force. There's some significant things that happen to each of us, to every one of us. The awareness in the recovery treatment industry has moved so strongly towards addressing what they call, what do they call it, Tom?
I don't know. I'm not sure what you're talking about.
It's all trauma-based, trauma-informed recovery. Right. Adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, A-C-E-S.
Mm-hmm.
Massive study done by Kaiser Permanente in California many, many years ago. Outrageous results indicating the high correlation between children that have had early trauma. And trauma can just be a separation from a parent. It could be a medical condition. It could be any number of things. That the tendency towards correlation with addictive disorders, mental health disorders, and physical disorders such as cancer, diabetes, all these other things, is increasingly relevant or prevalent. So in my case, I was, you asked me what led me to be, to move to the path of recovery. You know, we don't do anything unless it gets really too severe. And then looking back at the trauma I had, and many people identify that have been adopted. I was adopted, but I was adopted at 10 days old in my early, early life. Nonetheless, there's a significant driving force to being adopted. And with that came the early childhood double bind. When I was informed by my folks at the age of 4, recommended by Dr. Spock to let your child know that they were adopted, you know, not to keep it a secret. Well, the double bind was, you know, oh, you know, we picked out the cutest little baby, you know, and it was me. And, you know, and even though I was adopted, you know, and we love you very much, nobody has to know about it. So there's this weird kind of burying with good intentions of some kind of a secret. And the speculation on that leads to the broad spectrum between what I heard was described as the alcoholic personality as being grandiose on one end and low self-esteem on the other.
And my egomaniac with an inferiority complex.
Exactly. Exactly. And my grandiosity, even as a young child, was envisioning the limousine arriving to return me to the throne, the princely throne of Alan Spencer Schwartz. And on the other end was the speculation of being cast aside by a poor, desperate woman. And in my drunken days as an adult wandering the streets of Manhattan, I would see bag ladies and approach them, asking them what their name was, because I knew my biological mother's name. And so it wasn't until recovery and delving into, looking into the past and understanding the root of our character defects that I was able to put things in place. And I actually discovered my biological family only this past year.
Wow.
And it's been a remarkable unfolding. Had I continued to drink, I don't know if I would bother or just get disgusted or whatever.
But we definitely wouldn't be present for the experience the way that you are now.
No, certainly no intention, direction, follow through, you know, what have you. So as the course of my life turned, when I was in Stony Brook as a pre-med bio major, I had, I was very gifted in sciences and math in high school, tested very high in the SATs, and so I was able to get into Stony Brook, difficult school. And I've always wanted to experience what LSD was from reading the Scientific American articles, you know, that spiders would weave more symmetrical webs and what have you. And I proposed in my senior thesis, I wrote away to Sandoz to get a sample, and I was denied. But in Stony Brook, we had plenty. And talk about a mind-mood-altering experience. The sciences were no longer relevant, you know, to my course of discovery. I was drawn into science primarily because I had a curiosity about my genetic background. And the theory of nature over nurture, all those things I studied in social science, you know, really became irrelevant when I had this shift in perception. And I pursued a whole different course and changed majors to actually to art history, the history of art. Of course, it provided me with a fuller set of answers than science was providing. With, you know, I could relate to things like a nice Jewish boy relating to the Pietà, a contradiction in terms of religion, in terms of the exploration of beauty and the depth of human emotion and feeling, which was one of the things that drove my interest in jazz. This was music of deep, centered emotion that I could relate with. And when I got exposed to the visual arts, that grew even more and more to the extent that I ended up changing majors. And it's important to consider this was at a time when the Vietnam War was going on, when we had the draft, when people were trying to stay in school. And you would say, what is the relevance of an art major? We could use you for fodder. Right. if you're not going to be a doctor, you could be fodder. But fortunately, I was able to transfer into school and continue my pursuits with artistic and interests, endeavor, and what have you. And I transferred to Pratt Institute, good art school. And when I graduated Pratt, changing majors a couple of times, I went into the field of advertising. I used to do a lot of commercial art in school. My father had a printing plant in New York, and actually he used to print the art gallery catalogs for the Madison Avenue Gallery. So I was exposed to art, to printing process, to production, and what have you. And I went into advertising, and I made good money. My daughter was just born in 1970, and it wasn't as glamorous as you see on TV, Mad Men. I did drink a lot. I preferred hanging out on the shipping dock and smoking with the shipping personnel. And it really just drew the soul out of me. And it came to my understanding that what I was doing wasn't relevant, you know. It just didn't feed a need for relevancy. To discover purpose in one's life is really necessary for the path to authenticity. You know, just as you're drawn by your passions, by your heart, to help and work with other people, this is part of what authenticity is, and I hear it in so many of your other interviews. Extraordinary. In any event, I ended up changing careers because I had the benefit of taking an art therapy course at Pratt, and I did an internship at Downstate Hospital with pre-adolescent boys, young boys in a locked unit that had actually killed other children in their lifetime. And here I was brought in as an art therapy intern. And how do I communicate with these children whose lives, we talk about trauma, have had nothing but trauma-based existences? And the involvement of art, the manual ability to just take a gob of paint and spread it over a sheet of paper and add different colors to it, brought a channel of expression that was well beyond language. And that impressed me. So I ended up taking a job in special education. I worked with the Catholic Charity Learning Center right in Brooklyn in Park Slope, in walking distance from where I live. And I went to graduate school. I had a young daughter on the way. Not on the way. She was there already. And took a while for me to realize that I was making half the salary that I was making in advertising. And in February of 1971, I developed what proved to be catastrophic testicular cancer.
Oh, my gosh.
And I had extensive surgery. So when you talk about trauma-based histories, this was way out of the ballpark for me. But also, looking at it, you know, why me?
Right.
You know, this existential question, why me? And in my case, the fueling of my alcoholism from this goes now from 1971 till 1988, was not even realizing how fear-driven I was that the cancer would return.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I completed 3 years of chemotherapy very successfully, they wanted me to take another year. And I said, forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to take another year. And I became manic. I turned my classroom over to my assistant. I caught a flight to California, to Los Angeles, where I had some family. And I wanted to connect with my professor mentor from Pratt, Barry Schwartz, no relation, but truly influential person in my life. And he had taken the position of director of the Dean of Humanities for UCLA Extension. And I was off and running on a manic episode that lasted over a year, which included a couple of arrests and a couple of mental health incarcerations.
Mm-hmm.
And that was only because my address when I landed in California was at my uncle's house, was 626 North Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
So every time I got arrested for something, you know, the family would come in.
Yeah.
But when we talk about experiential learning, that was the real learning place, was in jails and mental health facilities. Given a number, I was at the Neuropsychiatric Institute at UCLA. I could tell people I studied there.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I was asked to leave against medical advice.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did not want to take the medication they were offering.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, as a highly evolved neuropsychiatric facility, that we could talk.
Can't
we talk about this?
Yeah. No, just take the medication, Alan.
So talk about the ups and downs. You know, I ended up spiraling into a deep depression and was escorted to the airport. I was arrested for selling trinkets at a diner in the early morning hours. When the waitress returned,
I'm imagining you with a trench coat on, and you open it, and you have pocket watches hanging from it.
No, I had handcrafted leather items made with guitar strings and beads. I was a hippie.
Yeah.
But the police had breakfast there, and they found it difficult to comprehend that I offered to pay with trinkets rather than cash.
Oh, boy.
And it was the second time it happened. The first time was in Malibu, where I offered a selection of seashells I had gathered. So my grasp on reality was certainly altered, you know.
That's out there.
It's out there.
I don't have money, but I do have these seashells.
That's right. You do have to understand I was not only in an altered state, I was in an altered universe.
Yeah.
Thinking that cancer was going to return, I was going to die anywhere. And it's a whole different spin on freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose, you know. And Janet Joplin died of an overdose. And I'm still here alive and able to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've ended up working in the recovery field for 30 years, you know.
Doesn't seem possible, does it?
Part of my background when I certainly was trained in visual media and what have you, and after I came back, was stabilized and what have you, I got a job teaching media and visual literacy at Brooklyn College under a federal grant. And it was just wonderful. You know, I mean, I was very filled with myself. I would lecture with a half cup of coffee and a half cup of rum. A lot of the veteran outreach students that worked in my lab wanted to work for the photo department because we had a triple beam scale. So they would chop and cut drugs, and I'd get a cut. And it was just living a fantasy. And then I entered the interconnect world when AT&T divested all of the baby bells, and I ended up selling technology phone systems. I'd always been a photographer and freelance, what have you, and that was always a theme. It still is in my life. I think I've taken your picture a couple of times.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say.
You know, and I got the call from my father. I was adopted, the only child. And when I was a kid, they said, "Alan, how would you like to have a little baby brother or sister?" And I was maybe 5-6 years old. I definitely did not want any competition.
I imagine you saying, "I would rather not."
Way back then. I had difficulty reading. I don't know if it was an ADD or whatever it was, but my mother got so frustrated trying to teach me how to read. She got really angry, and she says, "If you won't do this, I'm going to bring you back to the orphanage."
Oh, boy.
And so that notion of...
that's terroristic, isn't it? I mean, that... Now, come on. To hear that as a little kid, that'd be pretty scary, right?
You know, we do things that are driven by our emotions that go far beyond our intellect. Who has never snapped out in anger about someone and regretted it?
Right.
You know, in our program of recovery, that phrase, "We will not regret the past nor shut the door on it," holds so much depth for the kind of self-healing individuals have to go through so that they can make peace with themselves.
Well, and you know, one of the things that I think is really beautiful about it is that, you know, those things that... we suffer can become our superpowers. I mean, you know, we're two guys who our entire lives have, you know, we've devoted to helping other people, and none of that would have ever happened if we didn't stop drinking.
Right.
And had we not needed help, someone helped us, you know? And then to, I don't know about you, but for me, doing this, it's to have somebody, you know, once in a while, have somebody, "Man, thank you so much for doing what you did." And, you know, and I almost feel silly being thanked because, you know, I mean, listen, this is just what you do. Like if somebody shows up and, you know, they're in crisis and they need help, and I know how to do it. And not only do I know how to do it, but I know what it feels like to suffer the way they have suffered. Of course I'm going to help. How could I not? And, you know, sometimes that means dropping everything and helping right now, right?
I have seen people in long-term recovery that are just too busy to help other people. We are very fortunate, Tom. The blessing and the structure of the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous is based on experiences, the experiences of those people, the discovery that Bill Wilson had when he found he was able to share his experience with another drunk, and whether or not it made that other drunk any better, he was better.
Right.
He avoided going into the bar at that hotel, wherever it was.
Yeah.
And the nature of sharing one's recovery with someone else. You know, I was on the Florida Christmas party. My drinking had evolved to actually round-the-clock drinking. And in my professional career, the aspect of my professional career when I went into technical sales in New York was such that I was recruited by a computer consulting firm that liked my manner of presentation. They offered me a job, and I said, gee, I'd like to work with you, but I don't know a thing about computers. And they said, great, the less you know, the more you'll sell.
Wow.
Here's a kind of technical logic. You know, if I needed a propeller head, they would provide me with one.
Right.
But my skills, though I didn't realize at the time, is centered in a genuine interest I have in people. And it enabled me to cultivate a database of customers from the Federal Reserve Bank to, David Crystal, a fashion designer. Izod Lacoste, they had a number of lines. I had to go through more security to get into this fashion design house than I had to go through to get into the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. You know, I had Atlantic Container Line. I had many, many gifted people simply because of the work of the consulting firm that I worked for. They were brilliant. And they were also, we celebrated with like not only a bottle of Stoli, but this exotic herb came out of the freezer and some white powder, and we were off and rolling, baby. I went to conventions twice a year from the borough's user community, and here we were, bankers in three-piece suits with wingtip shoes doing lines of coke with rolled-up $100 bills. In the late 70s, in the 80s. I mean, astounding. So, in any event, I kept getting different offers to work for people. And I actually took a job to be a Northeast Regional Sales Manager with a Menlo Park-based company that's not too far from Palo Alto. And as long as you made it for the quarterly meetings at the sound of the bell in the morning, you were good to go. And even though I was producing, I only worked with clients that drank and drug like I did. And finally, I get the call, you know, that my numbers just weren't matching up with their expectations. And finally, I was let go. So I try to focus on, look, I had over $6 million in sales last year. They said, that was fine, but you were projected for 12, you know. And so the harsh reality of being rejected again when my drinking had really radically escalated was such that I ended up, figured I'd be on my own. My drinking increased. I ended up taking a telemarketing job, and I was grateful to get through a 9-to-5 day without picking up. But in the evenings and the weekends, it was the Oblivion Express. And finally, a friend, you know, leaned over to me when I was on the floor at a Christmas party. And he said, Alan, you don't have to drink like that anymore. And I was shocked. I was shocked. How dare him? You know?
Yeah. Who do you think you are to acknowledge reality? And
that's what he said. Yeah. Who the hell?
Yeah.
And when it came to that fateful day, and for my day, when I hit a bottom, I didn't have a car crash. I didn't kill anybody. I just came to for another day when I could not go into the office. And I heard my boss's voice over the phone reminding me that it was a Monday morning and to please give them a call and inform them of my plans for the day. My reality came to a crashing halt. And I ended up calling that guy that leaned over me that was concerned if I suddenly stopped drinking, I might go into convulsions. So one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, there's something that cuts through conventional boundaries or whatever it is. And even though I've taken all these clinical classes and all this other stuff, there's a sense of human connection that is essential in order to be able to be present for another human being to help them. And you and I are both blessed with this capacity. It's a gift we have.
It's the gift that you shared with me. You know, that's how our relationship started.
You share it with other people, you know.
Yes.
I remember when you worked for the, you worked with Jackie. Was that public relations department?
Yeah, marketing and PR, yeah.
Marketing, PR, and that's what we ended up doing, marketing and PR. I mean, I was in admissions. And the call I had to make, a follow-up call with an admission that we worked on for almost a week, on the verge of getting through, finally getting the client to agree to his parents, flying him to us, speaking to that dad in the early morning, only to find out that his son had passed away, ripped something out of me.
Yeah.
How do you address that voice, the depth of sadness of a parent losing their child?
Yeah.
To an addiction-related disorder.
Yeah. You know, which
we are supposed to be able to fix.
Well, and what this brings me to is, I think when you're not in this world that we're in, you're a little more in touch with how tragic it is.
Yeah.
And we're so used to it that, you know, but when I think about who I was when I called you.
Oh, yeah.
I was lost. So lost.
You had the capacity for anger, just like I was resentful over that guy leaning over me.
Well,
what do you know about me?
Yeah, well, I had a little liquid capacity going on, too.
Absolutely.
That brought that anger out, which what was really going on is I was sad.
Yeah.
I was sad because... Yeah. This is part of why I created this podcast and called it what it is, The Path to Authenticity, because for me, I got to that place. It was an existential crisis.
Oh, absolutely.
What am I doing with my life? And in fact, that later that night, when after that call later that night, I've probably told you this story before, but I ended up on a gurney in an emergency room.
Oh, really?
And, and long story short, someone very important in hindsight, there was a little girl. When I was in fourth or fifth grade, I remember the teacher going around the room and asking us all what we wanted to be when we grew up. And there's this little girl named Angie Lee who raised up her hand and said, I'm going to be a doctor. And, you know, and Angie Lee and I, we were like that in gifted classes together all through high school. Like I was, you know, I was a smart kid and, and, you know, fast forward a couple years, 23, I stumble my way into an emergency room, stinking of whiskey, cussing out a nurse, and up walks Angie Lee.
Ooh, wow.
Doing her residency.
Oh, serendipity, baby.
And I remember how loving she was to me. How kind she was to me. I remember her rubbing my forehead and feeling the love in her hands. But she looked at me and said, Tom, what are you doing with your life?
Yeah.
What are you doing with your life? But that, and you know, like that I knew in that moment when she showed up there that I was supposed to be sober now. I knew it. I knew God put her there and this was it. You know, it's over. That part's over. And although I wouldn't stay, I refused to stay. And there ended up a visit to the jail down the street overnight. The next day,
You know,
I talked to you. That was on a Friday. Saturday, midday, I'm out of jail, and a sister packed a bag for me. My parents took me to the airport, and I've been here ever since. And I met you that Monday.
Yeah.
You were the first amends I made in recovery was to Alan Spencer Schwartz to apologize for calling him what my dad described as everything but a white man. Going back to the, I wasn't true to myself. You know, I made decisions that were contradictory to who I was as a human being in order to please other people or not be rejected or whatever. And the next thing you know, I'm lost, and I'm 19, 20, 23 years old. Who the hell am I? What happened to me? Mm-hmm. I'm stuck. What do I do now? And I didn't know how to deal with it. Didn't know where to go except for a bottle.
Yeah.
Because that's what people did in my world.
Absolutely.
The guys, that's what they did.
When
they were distraught. And, there was no drinking this away. And I knew, I don't know. I think deep down I knew there was more. I knew I had something in me that I wanted to be something, do something. I knew I had a purpose, but I didn't know what it was, and I wasn't fulfilling it. So, yes, I feel like that's very important for someone who wants to be sober. And in, you know, TED Talk world, what is your why? You know, people talk about what is your why, and you know, we have to have a why. Why am I doing this?
Yeah.
And you know, to be happy, I think we have to have a good answer to that question.
Oh, no. The why can be so different for so many different people and yet have an overlay of similarity. We are bound together in this human condition. And in order for my recovery to work, you know, I have to continue to show up. This COVID thing and, cutting down on meetings and everything has had the impact of a radical increase, 60% in Palm Beach County of people that have relapsed. Mm. And I'm not just saying alcohol, it's related to all kinds of mind mood altering substances. 60% increase in relapses and in fatalities. Mm. And it doesn't make the headlines as much as this COVID thing does.
Yeah.
But resources, to find resources for people, is one of the reasons why I became involved in this advocacy process. The frustration of people wanting to get help without having the availability of insurance or funding or something to get them into. You know, in Palm Beach County, we used to have 8 publicly funded programs for men and women, and for women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's down to 1.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is Drug Abuse Foundation, DAF. And Wayside House now even takes insurance. But to find somebody a bed, you know, early on I got involved with the Palm Beach County Behavioral Health Coalition. I don't know if you've ever gone to their meetings. We meet on Tuesday mornings at 9:30.
Well, is that what was once the Palm Beach County Substance Abuse Coalition?
That's correct.
Yeah. I was there at the beginning of it. I actually worked there.
BBCSAC, yes. Yeah. Substance Awareness Coalition. What a concept.
Yeah.
To make people aware, to break down the stigma that keeps so many people stuck. And that constricts resources for them generally seeking help. And so advocacy is something I'm very strongly drawn to. Having worked in the initially, I worked in the public sector. Mm-hmm. I came to Florida because my dad had an incurable cancer. Something was going on with him. I'm the only child. In our literature, it says, praying only for a knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. Here I had just moved to Darien, Connecticut. I fell in love with a young lady in Codependence Anonymous. That suddenly was going south. And in any event, I had to leave. I knew that my purpose was to be there for my folks when they had been there for me. And my dad looked at me in the hospital bed, and he's a very strong, individualistic, mechanical person. He says, if I beat cancer, he's going to beat it. Mm. And I had another 8 years with him. We had another 8 years.
Well, you know, it's fun. One of the things I think about with you, and that just always kind of touched me, is when your parents were still around, you brought them with you everywhere.
I brought them what?
You brought them with you everywhere. You know, these,
oh, yeah.
When we worked together, we'd have these company Christmas parties or whatever. You'd bring, they'd God. Come, you know, your,
they couldn't believe your
parents were part of,
on.
Oh, it was really nice to
yeah.
see.
Celebrate recovery. They didn't know what was going on, but as long as I wasn't drinking, they were happy.
Yeah. Yeah. But you were a good son to them and showed them so much love. And
well,
I just have good memories about that. Yeah.
You know, the you talked about knowing our internal purpose and relating that to happiness. Harry Hamilton, God bless him, used to be so inspiring, talk about breaking down the stigma of being an alcoholic. He says, it's just a fact of my life. I'm neither ashamed or embarrassed by it, you know, but he would frequently quote the purposes of the 12th step in the prefix, in the preface, that the purpose of it was to restore us to being happy and usefully whole.
Yeah.
It's the whole purpose of the 12th step. Mm. I'm a 12th step evangelista. And the notion of meeting the addict where they are.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's, one of the things I've talked about this a little bit with different folks from our industry who I've had on the yeah. podcast.
Oh yeah.
There is this arrogance among a lot of people who work yeah. in our industry.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That's based in, well, this is the way it worked for me, so that's the way it needs to happen for you, or else you're not going to get better.
I know some of those people.
Well, yeah. Well, and it's a total crock of shit. It is.
Well,
and it's
slow awakening.
Now, it
awakening.
Now, I will say, you know, every great treatment facility there is started with somebody's passion of, I can do it better. I can help people. I know how to do this. So there's a lot to be said for that. But there's an advocate in the Chicago area. It's a group called Live for Lolly. And, you know, she advocates medication-assisted treatment and provides support for that. Because her brother died of a drug overdose.
Yeah.
And he had multiple treatments. And he wanted to go on, you know, an MAT program. He would have been willing to do that. He never really had the option to do that. Mm. And he died.
Yeah.
He died.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, people can be pretty close-minded about, listen, I mean, the point is survival and having the life you want. That's what it's about. I don't need you to get better the way I got better. I just want you to be happy. And, you know, and one of the things that I learned very early on in my career, and just sitting and watching people, learning from people who work with clients, is that the people who I really admired were the ones who remembered, these are people with lives and families and dreams and, you know, they're not here to fit into our little box.
Mm-hmm.
We're here to help them. That's the point. And going back to, I believe for me, there were reasons why I wanted to be sober. There were things I wanted to do. And if I didn't have that, I don't think I would have stayed sober. We have to have a reason to be sober.
A purpose.
a purpose, yes. But I believe I've worked for companies that were very much against medication-assisted treatment and would only use these drugs for detox purposes, great. You know, I mean, what's important to me about that is that as a treatment provider, you need to have a philosophical orientation and stick to it. The real problematic providers out there are the ones who try to be everything for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you can't do a good job and do that. Unless you're enormous and you have an army of, you know what I mean? There are exceptions, but for the most part, but I don't think, putting a 21-year-old kid who's been addicted to opiates for a couple years on Suboxone indefinitely makes sense. If it's a criminal or I'm sorry, a homeless person who's been addicted to heroin for 25 years. I mean, harm reduction, you know, that makes more sense to me. It's not only meeting the person where they're at, but also treating them as an individual. My convictions based on what worked for me or what didn't, you know, doesn't necessarily apply to everyone. You know, we get too hung up on that stuff. A lot of us.
I like the phrase, to maintain an open mind.
Yeah.
But both you and I have worked in clinical environments and have attended staffing meetings and supposedly developed treatment plans.
Right.
Which were often formulas or what have you.
Right.
And, you know, some of us that work in the field are truly gifted and are able to simply be ourselves when we're communicating with another person.
Mm-hmm.
It became very, very clear to me that there was another path for my recovery process that I was finally led to after 30 years, you know, is the importance that we place on the 11th step is in sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, her or it. I have to add her or it.
Yeah.
And that's when I made a decision to follow a spiritual path and to get ordained and to start to explore prayerful intention. And one of the mentors whose literature really helped me so much in the clarity of the path that I was about to embark on was Thomas Merton.
I was hoping you were going to say him.
And he, in a letter he wrote, in this letter, it became a prayer that's one of my favorites, where it says, our job is to love others without stopping to inquire whether or not they are worthy.
Right.
It is not our business, and in fact, it's nobody's business. What we are asked to do is to love. And this love itself will render both ourselves and our neighbors worthy. And so that message strikes me so deeply into my heart, way beyond treatment plans or philosophies or ideologies or anything like that.
Yeah.
That I have taken as... a recovery advocate is also one of ministry. Mine is a 12-step ministry, and over the past couple of years, I've become a prayer chaplain with Unity of the Palm Beaches. I've had the blessing of being able to serve at weddings, at the unions of people, as well as to deliver funeral services for parents that have lost their children to this disease. There is no greater sorrow than a parent losing their child. And it never gets easy, just as it wasn't easy when I was speaking to this father on that morning when we were arranging for his son to come into treatment and he died the night before. But something took over my voice in the sincere sadness and regret. And in this deep sense of loss and compassion was brought forth into that conversation. And the notion of simply being present for other people has enriched my life so much. And that's all the result of this long-term recovery. I am a person in long-term recovery. And that implies a number of things that are just astounding to me that continue to unfold beautiful things in my life. And I think I'm looking at the end. It's just over the horizon.
Yeah.
But I'm happy. I'm a happy alcoholic. And in Unity, Eric Butterworth had a beautiful definition of prayer. Because we do not pray for things we want. Just as in our 12-step process, we pray only for a knowledge of God's will for us. And that's an eternal thing. That's an eternal evolution that takes place. So if I may, I just want, it's fairly short, but it's from Eric Butterworth, Prayer Minister for Unity of New York City. And it says, prayer is not something we do to God, but to ourselves. It is not a position. It is a disposition. It is not asking, but knowing. It is not words, but feeling. It is not will, but willingness. And so I have a willingness to turn these things over to a power far greater than myself, and just hope to be of service to another person. Be it as simple as smiling at other people on my daily walk. And this is the gift we share, Thomas. We have a sense of wholeness that we've gained through recovery. And your path of interviewing people and getting at the root of this kind of purposeful living, the sense of authenticity, when we're living in an age of masks and masquerades, of self-importance and power, of destruction, which so violently erupted today in our government. I mean, where is the compassion that we want to receive unless we're able to give it to others? I just want to put in a plug, because advocacy is something I'm still discovering. There's a course I'll be taking through NAMI, our local NAMI chapter here in Florida. It's very good.
National Alliance for Mental Illness, right?
Absolutely. And it's on advocacy. But one of the projects I've been working on, I'm a volunteer, and I'm so much happier being a volunteer. In any event, my life continues to open up, and this promise of a new freedom and happiness is just within everyone's grasp if they just take the steps.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me that's really hard to do when you're in the thick of the suffering is you just can't imagine how great it can be. You know, I loved to drink. I had good times. I loved drinking. I did. I enjoyed it. You know, I mean, and I had my share of fun and it got bad. I mean, don't get me wrong, but you know, I have not been miserable for the past 25 years. You know, I wouldn't trade a second of it. I wouldn't. And I think that was a key thing for me, a key transition that I had to make before I was going to be sober, was I had to see what I could gain from being sober rather than what I was losing. And the only way that was going to happen was for me to go through enough pain. And I did. God gave me enough pain.
They say no pain, no gain. Misery is optional.
Yeah. Well, Alan, so, you know, one of the questions I ask of everyone before closing these episodes is, if there was a time in your life when you needed a word of advice or support, when would that have been? And what would you go back to the younger Alan and say?
Ooh, that's a tough one. So many challenges I've faced in my life. And the one thing I had, the one person that stands out just immediately is my Uncle George. He's like a second father to me. And as simple and as humble as he was, no matter what kind of jackpot I was in when I had cancer, he was there, flew across California to be at my bedside. When I came to live in California, you know, he was my uncle's a famous songwriter and was married to my father and my uncle's sister. Aunt Ruth was a very early performer, a singer. She was on one of the first TV broadcast shows. In any event, Uncle George was such a practical man. And at every impasse I faced, he says, "We're with you, boy. I'm on your side." And it's that simple voice of encouragement. When I could only see no solution, only see the darkness of something coming ahead. And this whole gift of understanding that most of recovery becomes what we put forward in our minds. That little 24-hour book I read on a daily basis for recovery helped me focus on a tiny positive aspect. Just for the day. One of those meditation books, just for this day. When I was a young boy, my father didn't have a problem with alcohol. He couldn't understand why I drank. Yeah. He saw me in one of my more elegant apartments doing lines of coke in the mirror, and his tears came into his eyes. He said, "Why would you do something like that? Why would you put something into your body that harms you?" And I have to look at the brighter side, that there were people that were there that tried to show me the light. And it's just like you and I, you know, it's like that little sign. There's that little song. It's so ridiculous, Tom. It's so ridiculous. It's such a damn serious, deadly disease. Undescribable sense of hopelessness. Unbelievable. And that little song that goes on that says, "If you get to heaven before I do, just drill a hole and pull me through."
I don't know that song.
Oh, if you get to heaven before I do, Tom, better drill that hole and pull me through.
Well, let's hope I don't get to heaven before you. No offense, Alan, but I don't want to get there before you do.
This is no race. You know, but Bill Wilson pulled Dr. Bob through that little hole and countless others as a result, and has gifted us with the ability to be genuine and compassionate in speaking with another suffering soul. But they have to make the decision.
Yeah.
People that can't get sober don't realize that there is a problem they have to surrender to. And if they don't have a problem that they can surrender, there's no redemption. There's no belief that they can come to believe that there's some power greater than themselves, let alone making that decision to turn their life and the will over to this unknown, this great unknown thing.
Here's another truth that I, you know, pointed out to a client yesterday.
Yeah.
I talked to him about how one of the prayers I say every morning is what in the 12-step community we call the 11-step prayer, but is the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi.
Yes, yes, yes.
If I don't know sadness, I don't know joy.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth. Mm-hmm. That's how we find it. And, you know, we get so stuck in the suffering part of it that we lose sight of the fact that that's just part of life. And that, you know, and the first time I remember it being described was, mutual friend of ours who has passed now, but he used to do a lecture at that facility where we worked about grief, and he had lost a daughter and a granddaughter. And one of the things he talked about was how grief was another expression of love. And if love didn't exist, grief wouldn't exist. It's hurts, but it's only because love is there.
Deep. Yeah.
And one of my favorite people who I've met over the years, who's been a spiritual guide to me, one of the things that attracted me to him was hearing him share one time, you know, if you miss somebody, that's because you love them.
Yeah.
That's how you know. And I blew my mind. I just never thought about that before. I think, you know, what we're, if you're listening to this, what you're hearing from us is, you know, I think I can speak for you in saying, have chosen to live a life of continual growth.
Yes.
That's what this is. That's what this is. And when we become tuned into that and just wanting to be better and continuing to grow and improve, I mean, you know, we forget about the other stuff. Like, I don't think about drinking, you know?
A lot of it is true. We're able to, when they say we cannot regret the past, nor wish
to shut the door on it.
And, you know, my sponsor, very, very spiritual man, he's passed on a couple of years now. Wanting to seek, you know, a closer connection with the higher power, he went to a lay brother program in a monastery in which he lived like a monk for, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd sleep on a hard bed and go through all the disciplines and the days of silence and the early morning vespers and the prayers and everything. And one of the people he met there, you know, one of the brothers at this monastery says, you know, he said, we're like rough stones that rub up against each other and make each other smooth. And so that's why it's so important to work with other people, because I have been smoothed out by people. I thought I was helping, and they certainly helped me a lot more. So there's no end to it, Thomas. And, you know, the beauty continues to unfold because I've had a taste of it. And it's something I want more of. It's my intention on a daily basis to do something that is a little more positive. Now, I am certainly not a saint. I screw up a lot. I beat myself infinitely less than previously. You know? But in any event, there are the moments I take in my day in which I set aside everything. I walk. I listen to music. I love people. I look at people, and I genuinely love them.
Yeah.
And in this life of prayer, important in the course of my day, whether I know what I'm doing or not, is that once a man asks, "What did you gain by regularly praying to God?" The man replied, "Nothing. But let me tell you what I lost. I lost anger, ego, greed, depression, insecurity, and fear of death." Sometimes the answer to our prayers is not gaining, but losing, which ultimately is the gain. And that brings us back to surrender. And I just surrender to the beauty of your intention and your show, of you reaching out to pull forth from other people what makes their lives significant. And it's all part of this great, fast human story. I can hardly wait to listen to a few more of your episodes, Tom. I
appreciate that.
Thank you so much. And well, the diversity of people. Oh,
and good. Listen, this has been great. I've really enjoyed this. And, you know, we've been doing this for you. I could talk to you forever. But, you know, I think I can accurately be described as having been a rough stone, probably still a rough stone. And you were the rough stone that I
still rubbing up against.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that. And, you know,
Mutual. It's a beauty of it. It's a mutual beneficial.
Well, thank you, Alan.
Oh, thanks, Tom, so much. And keep on. You've got something here, and it's just beautiful to watch it unfold. Thank you so much.
Alan Spencer Schwartz, who's also quite the photographer. Just to go back to a couple of things that came up in the episode when Alan was talking about the particular job and going through what he called APT, that's Addictions Professional Training. It was a program that Hazelden did at the time. We talked about MAT and may have clarified that that's medically assisted treatment. What that refers to, if you don't know about it, is when someone's an opiate addict, heroin addict, one of the approaches to helping them get better is to keep them on a smaller, controllable dose of a drug of the same class. If you've heard of methadone, if you've heard of Suboxone, those are basically what those drugs are designed to do. And some addiction treatment facilities only use them to detox people, to titrate people off drugs. And then there are providers that believe more in keeping people on for an extended period of time, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 6 months, depending on the philosophy and the approach, sometimes even indefinitely. So that's what he was talking about. And when we talked about Thelonious Monk, that was the record. It's Monk Palo Alto. The 16-year-old kid I referred to is a guy named Danny Scher, who now is a retired concert promoter of some notoriety. So I hope you enjoyed this. It meant a lot to me to have Alan on the podcast. It's something I've intended to do for a long time. Great guy. Anyway, if you enjoy listening to the podcast, please take the time to leave a review, a rating, or both on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser, or wherever you choose to listen. You can subscribe, like, follow, whatever, at Amazon, on Apple Podcasts, on Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Patreon, Podbay, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, and I'm sure a lot of other places I'm not aware of. If you know someone who'd enjoy a particular episode or the podcast itself, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you have any questions or comments, I'd love your feedback. You can call and leave a message at 561-247-4757. I'd love to hear from you. For early access to the newest episodes, as well as unedited interviews, you can support the show on Patreon. That's patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Just to remind you, there's the artwork to commemorate the 100th episode of the podcast created by Heather Sundquist Hall. It's available in a couple different sizes. You can find the link in the show notes or visit goldenhourprints.com. A portion of the proceeds will go to the I Speak Media Foundation. Thank you to Punk Rock Opera, the band whose music you hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist under a Creative Commons license. I want to thank our sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. I want to thank Wendy Chin at Equivox. And again, The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the I Speak Media Foundation. You can visit thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can listen to the show there. Join the mailing list. Would be a big help. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. You can like the show on Facebook or follow on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. In the show notes, there's a link to the Spotify Sunday playlist, which I have updated recently with some really cool music that's new to me and old favorites. Anyway, thanks again to Alan Schwartz. I hope in a couple weeks we'll have a new president. In the meantime, be nice.
I died on the street.
Hey, we need a guitar player.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.